Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and Focus on Africa today includes a conversation about the skyrocketing cost of living in Egypt.
I've just come back from a supermarket, and I went to the milk shelves and discovered that it has gone up from last week. And just minutes later, when I came to the cashier to pay for the stuff, it's no longer 150-something, it has crossed 160. So staff don't have the time to change the price tags on the products on the shelves.
We're here to find out why Kenyan doctors are prepared to defy a court order to strike over the treatment of medical interns. And do the Africa Games currently underway in Ghana justify the cost? Some say yes, and some say no.
I really don't think that we have our priorities right. We have been declared insolvent. We have been declared bankrupt. This government has a penchant for big spending on things that really are not priority.
Although our pockets is not sweet, but we are going to use this to, you know, cheer ourselves up. So I'm very happy and excited. Ghana, go for gold!
It's Thursday, the 14th of March. First, we go to Nairobi. Kenyan doctors began a strike last night in support of medical graduates who are waiting to be employed in the public health system. They are concerned that these doctors, interns they called, are stuck in limbo. The government says it doesn't have the money to pay them. They say their conditions of employment need to be reviewed in the round in that case, and not just their pay. This is a crisis because interns make up nearly 30% of doctors in Kenya's understaffed public health sector. Neither side is prepared to back down. But there's been a development, a court order. My colleague Richard Kagoe is in Nairobi with the details. Richard, you've got the latest news for us on the medical interns that were meant to be going on strike today. What's happening?
So, Audrey, the doctors are currently on strike in different parts of the country. So this is in solidarity with the medical interns who were supposed to be deployed 2 months ago. But now the Labour Court has stopped the strike. But what we are hearing is that the doctors' union is defiant and saying that they're going to go with a plan of withdrawing their services across all public hospitals in the country.
So essentially, the strike is going on. Are there consequences for the doctors?
What the judge has ordered is that the doctors, the Labour Minister and the Ministry of Health should have a conversation on Thursday by close of business and find out how they're going to resolve these issues. But well, we knowing that we've heard from the Deputy Secretary General who's saying that they're going to disregard that and they're still going to go with a strike which had been planned. So we are yet to see how this is going to really pan out, Audrey, because this is a court order and you're supposed to comply with it.
So in the meantime, Richard, you've been finding out exactly what the reasons are for this strike, right?
Yeah, precisely. So what I did is I had the chance of speaking to BBC Health correspondent Dorcas Wangira just to explain to me what are the underlying issues and why the issue about the deployment of medical interns seems to be a perennial issue that seems to be cropping up. So let's have a listen.
There is a lot going on. And there is a saying that every Kenyan is just one illness, one accident away from poverty because of how much it costs for healthcare. So there is a shortage of doctors. There are unemployed doctors, more than 4,000 of them. And then now here come the interns, the cracks of the matter. So interns are not students. They're actually doctors who have graduated. They're just waiting to be posted, and it's mandatory. Without the posting, they cannot get a license. WHO recommends one doctor to every 1,000 patients. In Kenya, the Kenya Doctors Union says that there's just one doctor for every 17,000 patients. So if you have 11,000 registered doctors, that's according to the Ministry of Health, and you have 55 million people, we have more than 1,200 interns who have not been posted yet. And many of them graduated in December. They finished their exams last year in July. So by law, they're supposed to be posted 30 days after their graduation. The government had told them January. Then January, it became February. We are now in March. The government says they don't have the money to post them. And that's why you have many of them still waiting at home, doing practically nothing. And now the doctors' union says, post this interns. We already have the doctors who are not even employed. Let's first sort the interns so that we have quality health care and with the human resource that is needed.
I wonder what conditions some of these interns and generally, you know, doctors in this country are exposed to. You have reported extensively mm-hmm. on Matters Health, and you've been to some of these facilities. You've witnessed, you know, what goes on there. What's the environment like?
If you've gone to a Kenyan public hospital, 99.99% you've been treated by an intern first, who, if the situation is beyond them, they'd now refer you to the specialist. So the intern works as a doctor, but with supervision. So they're a very important pulse of the public healthcare system. And many of them do rounds. They do ward rounds. They also attend to patients at the first point of call. And especially for emergency healthcare, you've had many stories here in Kenya of people dying because there was no one to attend to them. A very famous Kenyan writer was taken to the biggest referral hospital and he died. Ken Walibora, if you remember.
Yes, I remember him.
You hear stories of there's a woman who had to give birth at the gate of a public hospital some time back. So you need these interns because the specialist doctors are few, first of all, and many of them are engaged, neurosurgeons. We have very few of them. We have few oncologists. So that gap between the patient and the specialist, the intern fills that gap. The doctors' union says that they form 27% of public healthcare. That's 2 in every 10 doctors, but that's very, very crucial.
So the government says they don't have money to deploy these interns. How much, by the way, are we looking at here?
That's a very important question, Richard. And the Ministry of Health and the doctors' union had a collective bargaining agreement, and they agreed on an amount for the intern, 206,000 Kenya shillings, which is an estimate of $1,500. It may look like it's a hefty amount. There was a time even the Minister of Health on national television said that an intern earns more than a doctor, and there was a lot of outrage. So I spoke to one intern, Dr. Mike Micheni, and he says that they work so hard. And what they earn was agreed upon, and that's non-negotiable.
It's very important to realize that there was a collective bargaining agreement, a CBA, which was signed between the doctors and the government in place. And so when it was being signed, it's important to note that the terms that they had set in place for the doctors were commensurate with the amount of work that they do. So it is clear that the medical interns, by the time that it was being signed by the government, the intern is working these long hours, and a certain amount of money was set in place that would be matching the amount of work that they do.
So I'm wondering, what's then the government's position on this? How do they plan to resolve this?
The government says that it doesn't have the money. This is what the Health Minister, Susan Nakhumicha, had to say.
The conversation about internship is not just about posting. It's a bigger conversation about healthcare financing, that we must get our financing for healthcare right. In 2017, the KMPDU, Kenya Medical Practitioner and Dentist Union, signed a CBA regarding their internship to the level that their compensation per internship is 206,000 per month. That includes a salary and allowances. For now, that is unsustainable.
So we should presume that's an official response. This is the position of the government. So are they currently on strike? And if they are, how long do they intend to do this?
The strike is indefinite. In 2017, there was a long 3-month strike that took 100 days. Dr. Dennis Miskela is the Doctors' Union Deputy Secretary General. And this is what he had to say about why they're going on strike.
Internship by law is compulsory because that's where they learn their skills under supervision. Worst of all, you don't tell them when you're going to post them. So they can't even accept any gigs on their sides. Number two, they can't earn any living. Also, there's a knowledge decay. If you take, say, 2 months without practicing the theory you learned, you're going to forget.
So the doctors are gone on strike in solidarity with the interns. I don't know what this really means for patients.
That's right, Richard. Whenever doctors or other healthcare workers down their tools, it's the patient who usually suffers. And remember, even the doctors themselves could be patients. The union's leader is in hospital after he suffered an injury, so he also needs doctors to treat him. And for as long as many of us can remember, we've seen strikes in the public healthcare system, not just in Kenya, but all around the world, in the UK, in South Korea, Zimbabwe, Mozambique.
And how are Kenyans really reacting to this? How do they feel about this situation? Because they're the ones who pay the taxes. They're the ones who are going to be affected by this crisis. What are people saying?
People are angry depending on where they're from. And it will come to a point even that private healthcare may not be tenable. There's something being called private care for the poor, and where you have facilities mushrooming in residential areas. Who are running these facilities? The Doctors' Council shut down some clinics with fake doctors, with quacks operating them. So at the end of the day, the anger is coming from different sectors. Anger from people who are paying more, anger from the doctors who are not being employed. There's anger from people who are having fake professionals sorting this mess. And it can only get worse. And we do hope that the government does adequately respond and listen to the concerns that people have.
All right, so let's see how this pans out. But thank you so much, Dorcas, for coming to the podcast.
Yes, thank you, Richard.
BBC Africa health correspondent Dorcas Wangira ending that conversation with Richard Kague in Nairobi. Egypt is going through the worst economic crisis in decades, and that is saying something, because Egypt is no stranger to plunging currency, shortages, and high commodity prices. The Egyptian pound is now worth just a third of what it was 2 years ago. The value continues to drop, and for those who need to use dollars for services, the situation is dire. We'll hear the reasons behind this, but let's listen to the experience of Aya El-Bakri, a student enrolled online with a UK university. Like hundreds of others, Aya has had to drop her studies in psychiatry because she can't afford to pay for them anymore.
When restrictions on the foreign currency transaction were imposed, all the websites I used to pay through were blocked. Also, there is a tight limit on credit cards and a significant gap in the pound-sterling exchange rate between the bank and the black market. I was asking Egyptians living in the UK willing to give me pound sterling, and I will send the amount in Egyptian pound to their families here in Egypt. But when the crisis worsened, no one wanted to take the money in Egyptian pound because of the currency fluctuation. Now I'm so reluctant to apply for any further study or diploma. I don't know if I can manage to pay the tuition through official ways without the need to find relatives living abroad or searching for the currency in the black market.
So how did Egypt get to this point? And is there a way out? Magdi Abdelhadi is a former Middle East editor for the BBC. He's a writer now and lives in Cairo. Could he describe what people are going through?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, I was here exactly the same time last year in Cairo, and the prices have doubled. Yes, absolutely. And even some things have more than doubled. And to give you a small example, I've just come back from a supermarket, and I went to the milk shelves to buy a liter of soya milk, and I discovered that it has gone up from last week. Last week, I paid 130-something pounds, which is already very, very expensive. Most Egyptians can't afford that. This week, it was 150-something. And wow. Then when I pointed that out to the shop assistant, he said, "Sir, prices go up every hour." And just minutes later, when I came to the cashier to pay for the stuff, it's no longer 150-something. It has crossed 160. So staff don't have the time to change the price tags on the products on the shelves. So that gives you an example of how horrible the situation when it comes to the price of basic foods and commodities across the board. It really is very, very difficult for the vast majority of Egyptians.
So what's 160 Egyptian pounds in dollars?
Well, you see, the dollar today officially is 50 pounds to the dollar. Last year, it was 30-something to the dollar. So if you translate that into dollar, of course, it's not an awful lot of money. But if you translate it into Egyptian pounds, and let's say the average pay for a day laborer would be around 300 Egyptian pounds. And that is really the bottom of the scale.
Wow. Why is it escalating so quickly? I mean, from the time it takes you to walk from where you got the milk to the till, it goes up by 10 pounds more. Well, what's happening?
What's happening is that the pound has lost half of its value over the past year. And only the past week or so, there was yet another devaluation or floating of the pound. And that has brought it, the official price, up to £50 to the dollar. They're still far from certain that this is the real price of the pound. It's probably more expensive than that, the dollar to the pound, that is. So because of the recent devaluation, commodities continue, prices continue to rise, and people expect them to rise even further. Because Egypt has been in this position for so many decades, Egypt consumes, let me put it this way, it's a household that has to expend much more than what it earns in order to feed the family and to pay for the basic goods. What does it do? It borrows more and more to finance the credit. And during the 10-year reign of President Sisi, the level of borrowing has hit unprecedented levels. Egypt has to have something like $160 billion in foreign debt alone. So today, Egypt is borrowing to finance that debt. It's a vicious circle. So you can imagine someone having multiple credit cards. So they borrow money to pay the interest on that card and more money on the second card and so forth, on and so forth. And there is no end in sight. Luckily, and bizarrely and paradoxically, the war in Gaza has benefited the regime in such a way that only a year ago, no one was prepared to bail out the Sisi regime because of the way it has mismanaged the economy. But because of the war of Gaza and the importance of stability in Egypt for the wider region and the world, the IMF has come to the rescue. Arab Gulf states have also, they haven't quite given the regime money, but now the new formula is that they're not going to bail the regime out. They're prepared to buy Egyptian assets, which is precisely what happened. The Emiratis and the stalk of even the Saudis. And what the Egyptian state is basically selling the family silver. They're selling state assets. They're selling prime real estate on the Mediterranean or on the Red Sea to the rich Arab states, and that is one way to finance the deficit.
Right. I was going to ask you, what were the remedies that the Egyptian state has come up with? So more borrowing, selling off of assets, what else?
No analyst that I know of has predicted that this will end soon, because it's the same old policies that landed Egypt where it is today. That is, borrowing to finance mega infrastructure projects. Infrastructure projects are good in themselves, no one can deny that. But at what pace and what are the priorities? Building a new capital in the desert was not a top priority. Building a fast electric train linking the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, good idea in itself if you have the money. But if you don't have the money, you will have to wait or build it over a longer period of time, finance it by long-term loans. All of that the Egyptian state has ignored, and they've been taking short-term loans to finance infrastructure projects that do not generate money for the state, not in the near future.
Why has it taken that as an option? And you've said that this is a perennial problem in Egypt. When did Egypt become so comfortable with debt?
Well, I think with the regime of President al-Sisi, the borrowing to build has hit new heights, never like this before. You'll have to go back to the late 19th century and first early 20th century to one of the Ottoman viceroys that borrowed to such an extent that eventually led to Egypt being declared bankrupt. Now, Egypt was almost on the verge of that before the Gaza War. And then the Gaza War, as I said earlier, has paradoxically benefited the regime in that way. Only a year ago, The Economist, the British magazine, The Economist, had a piece with a headline, Sisi has ruined Egypt. This year, just a couple of months ago, there was a new piece saying, clearly written to the policymakers in Western capitals, hold your noses and bail out Sisi. You don't like him, but there is no other way. Egypt is too big to fail. And the Egyptian regime has counted on that. And luckily for it, it has delivered.
The Suez Canal is a key source of foreign revenue for Egypt. What's happening there? I believe that, disruptions in the Red Sea have cut income from
terrible.
There. Yeah.
Terrible news for the Egyptians, of course, because according to the head of the Suez Canal Authority, something like 40% of the ships crossing the Suez Canal have not been able to do so. So you can imagine hundreds of millions of dollars of income from the Suez Canal have already been lost this year. And it is one of the main sources of foreign currency to Egypt. Not only that, Because of the second source of foreign currency income to Egyptians, our remittances from Egyptians working abroad. And that is the first, the biggest source of foreign. That has also come down significantly. Why? Because the past year, the state had imposed an artificial price of the Egyptian pound. So Egyptians working abroad didn't want to transfer the money to their relatives and the families here through the official channels, because they will get a much worse price than the real value of the pound. So this too has gone down. So not only the Suez Canal revenues has gone down, but also remittances from abroad has gone down. Now there is an expectation, a hope, that the remittances will resume again once the price of the pound has gone down, and it's now £50 to the dollar. But it's still, everybody's waiting to see whether the sale of these real estate regions on the Mediterranean or the Red Sea will have an effect. And if they do, no one expects it to be long-lasting. It is just another tranquilizer, another buying of time. Unless the fundamentals of the regime's economic policies change, Egypt will find itself in another crisis, give it a year or two in time.
What are the economic experts actually advising that the Egyptian government do to stop this cycle?
Well, there is, of course, the advice is that they stop lavish spending on mega infrastructure projects, prioritize, incentivize the private sector, calling on the state and the military in particular to pull out of the economy, open the space for private sector so that they can encourage them and help them to go back to business, to produce more, eventually to export more, and this will bring in foreign currency to the currency. The regime says it's listening and it will change course, but not many people are actually optimistic that the regime will actually change its policies.
That was Magdi Abdelhadi, based in Cairo. The Africa Games kicked off in Ghana last Friday, bringing with it over 4,000 athletes who will compete in around 30 different sports. For the athletes, it's a chance to qualify for the Paris Olympics later this year. But it costs a lot to host these big, prestigious events, and there's usually criticism from all quarters about the cost. The opposition in Ghana accuses the government of having its priorities in the wrong order because the economy is doing very badly at the moment. The country is in deep debt and there's a cost of living crisis across the region. But is the financial juice worth the squeeze for Ghanaian taxpayers? I've been talking to BBC Africa sports reporter Emmanuel Akindibua.
The economy seems to be recovering from the devastation of the pandemic. It slumped to below 1% growth rates as of 2023, according to statistics by the IMF and the African Development Bank. But it's been projected to grow by about 3% in 2024. And pre-pandemic, it was one of the fastest growing economy in the African continent. Perhaps this was one of the reasons why the government considered the African game to be a big opportunity for them to expose their country to further investment and opportunities for growth.
But they've had to take a $3 billion IMF loan to repay. The currency has taken a huge knock. It seems like when you talk about recovery, that sounds a little bit enthusiastic, or rather optimistic right now.
Although the Ghanaian economy has kind of stumbled against big currencies in the world, it's kind of maintained some stability against other currencies, especially in the West African sub-region. And of course, the level of infrastructure in Ghana is still quite better than that of the biggest economy in West Africa, which is Nigeria. And that makes Ghana a kind of investment hub. So that puts Ghana in a very good position. The crisis in most of the West African sub-region, the political instability, the security situation also puts Ghana in a good position to recover faster than earlier projected. And that's why we could say Ghanaian economy is steadily on the path of recovery, though the government still has to deal with huge debt burden.
So what was most of the money spent on, the investment?
Well, according to the records given by the Ghanaian sports minister, about $243 million have been spent by Ghana to host the games, with $195 million spent on building new sporting infrastructure. the multipurpose sport complex being the biggest investment by the Ghanaian government. It cost $145 million. The Botiman Sport Complex will be hosting a large number of indoor sports at the Games, including tennis, badminton, volleyball, and it has an Olympic-sized swimming pool and a warm-up pool, which is considered to be one of the very best in Africa. The Ghanaian government also upgraded the University of Ghana Stadium into an Olympic standard with an Olympic track fitted. And this is at the cost of $34 million alongside the construction of a rugby pitch. They also built an ultra-modern games village at the cost of $16 million. So if you look at the total sum of money Ghana spent on facilities for the games, it's running to about $195 million. And the country's sports minister believes that there is no perfect time to invest in sports development and that this investment will outlive the current economic challenges the country may be facing.
Will the sports themselves, the games, cover the costs? And will these complexes that are being built be used for after the games? Because I know that we do look at these things and say, well, yeah, it will be used afterwards, but they never really used to the full potential.
The answer is probably not. When you look at the number of countries coming in, the number of athletes coming in, their spending power may not match the level of investment Ghana has made for these games. I spoke with an economist who lectures at the University of Ghana, who believes that the athletes coming or the visitors coming, the spending power they would have on the Ghanaian economy cannot automatically translate to gains for the economy, and that it may take a little longer before Ghana begins to count the gains of this massive investment they've made for the games. So the country's sports minister further said that after the games, they are hoping and they will be working on making their facilities as busy as it can be, hosting top international events, and they are even looking to make Ghana the hub of sports activities, not only in West Africa, but even in the African continent.
The investment we are put in is beyond the games. It's not just for the period of the 3 weeks period, but now we are going to have opportunity to host national events.
So that's Mustapha Usif, the Minister of Youth and Sport in Ghana. So let's take a look at the number of people, sports tourists, that have come to Ghana for the games. And what's the turnout been like? Have they been very well attended?
Well, I haven't seen much of the international tourists and fans coming, but of course, a sizable number did come. I saw some fans from Norway, some from Sweden, who told me they reside in Ghana and that they're cheering the Ghanaian teams at the games. But of course, we've seen a large number of athletes, about 5,000 athletes from more than 47 African countries are in Ghana as we speak. But aside from football events, it's been a sizable number of fans we've seen at the sporting event so far. Even at the opening ceremony, not many of the fans were seen at the 11,000 capacity University of Ghana Stadium. And this is largely due to the fact that the visibility about the games are very poor in a city like Accra. You drive around the entire city and you hardly could tell that this is the host city of a multi-sport event. There are no landmark or exciting billboards or signages to tell about the excitement that the city has on offer for tourists. So I'm not surprised that not a large number of visitors come in to watch the games, because even Ghanaians in their own domain are not aware such a big event is happening in their country.
Tell me what the opposition says about this, because I know that they've been quite vocal about the way the government has been handling the economy, and they have serious concerns about corruption.
2024 is a very significant year for Ghana. Beyond the African Games, the country would also be going to the polls to elect a new leader. And of course, one man whose name is at the top of the conversation is the country's current Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia, who is also playing a huge role in the running of the games and is the candidate of the ruling NPP party. The opposition have been using the huge spendings that the current government have had on the games to criticize them, describing it as a misplaced priority. Well, let's hear from Samuel Okujetu Ablakwa, who is a member of the Ghanaian parliament, who spoke with the BBC.
I really don't think that we have our priorities right as a nation. Look, we have been declared insolvent. We have been declared bankrupt. We have renegotiated all our debts. we have been downgraded by all the sovereign rating agencies. They have all downgraded us, giving us a junk status. And you see, this government has a penchant for big spending on things that really are not priority.
And that's an opposition member of Ghana's parliament, Samuel Okudzeto-Ablakwa. Now let's listen to Ghanaians talk about these games. What would you say, Emmanuel, their feelings are about the spending, about the games themselves?
To be honest, many of them are not bothered about the spendings because in reality, they believe that the government naturally would always call the figures, but they will be the one to fill it when they go to the market. They are excited that their country is in the spotlight. A lot of fans are coming around the University of Ghana where the games are old, and a lot of small businesses have their shops around and hopefully making some quick sales. They are hopeful that the games will bring them lots of exciting memories, and they are looking forward to having a great time with other Africans coming into Accra.
Emmanuel Akindubua is with BBC Africa Sport. Focus on Africa was put together by Richard Kague in Nairobi. The London lot included Daniel Dadzi, Alfonso Daniels, Sunita Nahar, and Stefania Okereke. Paul Bachibinga held it all together. Technical producers Jonathan Greer and Winnie Simon made sure we got on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.